What's up, guys, and welcome to Script Blast, the podcast to teach you how to write better screenplays and write a better life. Our guest today is Liz Manischill, indie film writer and director, as well as the co-founder of the Constellation Incubator, an eight-week workshop designed to reimagine a more sustainable ecosystem of filmmaking from development to distribution. If you've got a small team of filmmakers, a story you're passionate about, and don't know where to begin, the Incubator will teach you to think outside of the box and tailor the process to your team, no matter the budget or obstacles. The last day to enter is this Thursday, April 15th. For more information, check out filmfreeway.com/constellationincubator. Today, Hudson and Liz share and compare their journeys as writers and indie filmmakers and break down the steps of making your own film. She teaches us a few hacks of learning the business side of the industry and how to use it to our advantage, even with a micro-budget production. The truth of the matter is, if you have a story to tell and a team of passionate people by your side, you can tell it. But don't forget, all great films begin with a great screenplay. If you're ready to jumpstart your own screenwriting career and hone your craft, be sure to check out Script Blast Members, our exclusive online community for screenwriters where we hold each other accountable and support one another on our writing journeys. We have weekly video Zoom calls where we get together as a group to have a live video lesson with our host Hudson and catch up on our writing milestones. You'll also have access to our library of ebooks and worksheets, previous video lessons, and a judgment-free zone to share with the coolest writers on the planet. Right now, Hudson's in the middle of presenting a video series centering on writing unforgettable characters. So if you're interested, join today, free for a week, and catch next week's call at members.scriptblast.com. Now here's Hudson and Liz.
Awesome. Well, Liz, how are you doing? Thank you for hanging out and chatting today.
I'm good. Thank you for asking. My son was just having a tantrum because we took his pacifier away from him. So other than that, other than the rattle of hearing his cries going through my brain, I'm doing well. How are you?
Awesome. How old is he?
He's just turned 2 in February. So, but yeah, he's great. Motherhood is, parenthood is crazy.
So. Yeah. Well, let's follow that line of thinking because I have a bunch of questions for you, but I'm kind of curious because I know a lot of writers especially deal with this, much less indie filmmakers. How do you do it all with a kid?
Yeah, it's constantly a battle. And I think before I got pregnant, I was like, oh, I'm really nervous about balance. And I use the word balance a lot. And then I talked to a bunch of parents and they're like, there is no such thing as balance. I don't know what you're talking about. It is a constant seesaw. So I'm writing my third or fourth, I don't know what you would call it, but I'm writing a feature right now. Cool. And what I do is while he's at daycare, I meet with my co-writer and we have a half hour to an hour together where we talk about what we're going to do next. And then I pick a day every week where I have a 3-hour block, which I think is very luxurious, by the way. And I acknowledge that. And I just try to knock out some pages. So I only work during daytime working hours when he's at daycare. Yeah. I've tried to do the nap time thing, but nap time is not reliable. So like the only time you can carve out is actually when you're supposed to be doing other work, I think. Yeah. And that's unfortunately what I have to do.
Yeah. The best way I've heard it put is Shonda Rhimes. I just read her book, Year of Yes. And she talks about a lot of what you're saying is balance doesn't really exist. What exists is you sacrifice one thing for another and you're constantly just taking turns sacrificing, right? Sometimes you sacrifice for your son. Sometimes you sacrifice for your writing. Sometimes you sacrifice for your husband or whatever in life, your day job, all kinds of stuff. But it requires a sacrifice of some part. There is no such thing as balance.
1,000%. Mostly what gets sacrificed on my end is flossing. I was like thinking about it. I've like not flossed for a very long time. And it seems to be like, I can't figure out how to make sure I exercise, eat right, get my writing done and floss all in the same week. It never happens. So floss usually gets sacrificed.
Sacrifice one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
I just saw a factoid. I got an email that said like 20% of men had never flossed like ever in their entire lives.
Oh, wow.
Like I'm bad at it, but like I've done it before, you know.
That's amazing.
There's actually a good, I'm really killing it on the segues today. There's a good flossing analogy that I think has to do with writing and productivity, which is, gosh, I can't remember the guy's name now, but he talks about he wanted to pick up new habits. Mm-hmm. He didn't floss. He wanted to figure out how to floss every day. And so what he started with was just flossing one tooth. Like just the goal is do the smallest amount possible. You just floss one tooth every day. Because the idea was it wasn't about how much you're accomplishing. It's just about establishing the habit. Right. And so I think that's very applicable to writing. And a lot of what I will tell writers is, make your goal as tiny as possible, because if you make a goal of write 10 pages a day, what's going to happen is you're going to be like, oh, I've only got 10 minutes today. There's no way I'm going to do 10 pages. I'll just push it to the next day and then push it to the next day and push it. But if you say, I'm just going to write one paragraph, right? Then that's something you can sit down and do. And chances are you'll keep writing. So the smaller the goal, I feel like you actually get more done.
That's how I knocked out the first draft of this horror feature that I'm writing right now, is I established this thing for myself called 2 pages a day, December. Love and it. I just wrote 2 pages every day as a minimum. And I was still working another, I was still working another job. No, I wasn't. I just quit my job. So I had a little bit of flexibility, but I was writing when I was working my other job. So this is possible. But the idea is, at around 3 o'clock, I actually did like a meditation app for like 10 minutes. And I'm a hippie, but I'm not a new age hippie, if that makes sense. So like new age is weird to me. So I just like took it out, turned off Facebook, turned off Twitter for 10 minutes, meditated, or just laid there pretending to meditate. And then I wrote 2 pages. And honestly, it was like the most productive thing you could do. Awesome. I knocked out the entire feature in December because I wrote more than 2 pages some days.
Yeah, that's amazing. I don't have an official bio for you, but what I'm going to do is, because I connected with you, I think, for the first time a few years ago. I think you were on the tail end of your festival run with Speed of Life, and we were just starting ours. And so I kind of came familiar with what you were doing with Sundance at the time and stuff. So I'm going to do a quick kind of my summary of you, and then you tell me if it's accurate or not, because these are some of the things I wanted to get into as well. So writer, director, producer of kind of quirky but deep kind of dramedy films, a consultant who cares deeply about indie film sustainability and with a real emphasis on women in film, really caring about kind of the stuff you did with Sundance, kind of upending indie film distribution and figuring out new ways to help support filmmakers in that. Podcaster of Making Movies is Hard, and then my mom as well. Does that pretty much sum everything up?
I feel so seen. Yeah, I mean, the only thing is that as a consultant, you know, I'm a feminist and I make feminist content, but I don't differentiate the filmmakers that I support as a consultant. Gotcha. So, cool. And I think, anyway, we could get into that all day, but I believe that everyone has a right to tell a story and I want to help them tell that story.
That's awesome. I love that. So speaking of you as a writer, director, producer, because this is a lot of your story I don't know, of where you kind of started out, how Bread and Butter came together, how Speed of Life came together, and your journeys with those films. Because those were both films that I looked to when we were like putting together our pitch packages and looking at distribution and who's done it right, you know, and that I looked at you as a model. So I would love to know just how all that stuff came together, how you started down this path and why it matters to you.
Trying to think of where to start. I mean, for Bread and Butter, I had gone to film school because I was really afraid of filmmaking. I knew it's what I wanted to do, but I didn't know how to work a camera. I didn't know what an AD was. I didn't know anything, right? And so I decided to go to film school because that structure appealed to me. And when I graduated, I looked around and I was working at what I think was not the best job. I had applied to it during a writer strike at the time in 2010. And anyway, I was like, what am I doing with my life? I need to make the feature because that's why I'm in this, right? So I crowdfunded. And back in 2012, crowdfunding was still a really viable way to fund something. And it still is now, but it was less
competition at that point, maybe?
Yeah, there was still like enthusiasm behind the idea. It was a little bit novel. You had to explain in your email like what exactly Kickstarter was. And I kickstarted it and then I found money in other ways and I put together this film. And I did the same thing that I hear filmmakers do all the time. When I met with investors, I would say things like, we're gonna have a really low overhead, so of course we're gonna profit and all of these things, thinking that that was the truth because I had not heard otherwise. Yeah. And we got a really great distribution deal. I was working for a distribution consultant at the time, and he negotiated the contract and I learned about rights and territories and things that you wanna keep control over. And I think by now we're just about to go in the black, and this is six years later. Yeah. So, you know, I positioned this film as a success when I talk about it, but the data is that a success can be just recouping. Mm-hmm. And even before we recouped, it's like, we still were a success because we were making some money, which is crazy that the bar is so low.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I could get into Speed of Life, but I don't know if that is the detail of information that you were looking for.
Well, let's talk about it in terms, were you always thinking in terms of indie film or what really came first for you? Because I know some people are kind of like, I'm a writer, but I make films because that's the only way to get them made. I know people who just, you know, think in terms of I'm a director and I couldn't find any good script, so I wrote it. What kind of do you consider yourself first?
I consider myself a director first. Cool. And I used to consider myself a writer, but then I realized that I'm not that great of a writer. And I don't say that to be like, oh, self-deprecating. It's just like, I'm evaluating that there's a lot of things that I have avoided as a writer because they're not attractive to me that are what audiences like. Like, my stakes are always really low. Mm-hmm. I never want to put my characters through any pain or trauma. I get really protective over them, you know? I never want to write anything that feels like it would never happen in my life. Mm-hmm. And those are not the traits of a great writer. So the first two features I wrote because no one was offering me work and I wanted to get projects off the ground as a director. And then I learned through the process that the way to make content that's low budget and to like get projects off the ground is to have a lot of control over them. I've learned the hard way that when you're the hired director and you're not producing and you're not the writer, you're just waiting a lot of the time and you can't really, you don't have the jurisdiction to come in and kind of like fast track the project, nor, you know, nor should you, it's a collaboration. So anyway, point is I brought in a co-writer for this horror feature because I realized I'm not a great writer and I want to learn. And then I'm also pitching on projects that I am not writing at all from now on. So it's a combination of working with partners, becoming a better writer, and finding all the ways I can to direct as much as possible.
So your films have been what you would consider low budget.
yes.
So what do writers need to know if obviously the lower the budget, the more chances it is that your film is going to get made. So what do writers need to know about writing films that they can actually pull off themselves or collaborate with to pull off?
Well, it's funny because I think you have to have two versions of the film in your mind. Mm-hmm. The first version is like the one you're trying to sell collaborators on. It needs to be the best version of the script. It has to be imaginative. It has to have a wide scope. You could have car crashes. You could have all these things. It doesn't matter. Is it well written? Is it bringing someone in who wants to work on it? Yeah. And then you're going to hit the reality of like, can you produce this content? And so I think you need to be flexible to swap out all those car crashes, and all those set pieces. And you have to be willing to adjust your story, your dialogue, your script to the resources at hand. I can tell you right off the bat, things that you know very well, children, dogs, you know, visual effects, stunts, these are all really expensive. And if you also want to think about it, characters are expensive and days are expensive. So the longer your script is, the more expensive it most likely will be, unless it's a one location, entirely dialogue-based film. And then the more characters you have, the more expensive your film will be.
That's great. So for you, you started out directing, writing for yourself. I imagine, what was your goal? Like, what's the big goal? And maybe it is still the big goal, because I look at you as like this kind of, you know, indie film master, but I imagine you probably had loftier goals to, you know, do a lot of kind of studio stuff and all that. Yeah.
Oh my God. You're so nice to me. You know, the goal is to, I always say it's like to have a place at the table, if that makes sense. Like I want to be a part of the conversation with Mariel Heller and Chloe Zhao and, you know, Jeff Nichols. And, you know, I want to be in the conversation. I want to be on the list of reps when they're pitching directors for projects. It's not necessarily to direct studio features. I would clearly love to, but I also think that there's a downside to all of that. And I'm just getting a preview of that now. I think that once you hit a certain level of film, you're really contending with a lot of voices and a lot of cooks, and I'm not super interested in that. So I'm still just plugging away on what I think is the long game. If I just keep on producing content that I'm proud of, that has a distinct voice, I do think I'm going to eke my way into the ecosystem that way. But yeah, it's not necessarily studio features. It's to be seen of as a viable commercial entity as an artist.
Talk a little bit about Bread and Butter, your first feature, because I want to know really what lessons you learned off of that and then how you applied them to your next film, Speed of Life. Because we're just coming off our first feature, which between filming and release is 4 years. COVID had something to do with that, but a very long period of time. So we're just now figuring out and learning those lessons and what can we apply to this next one and how can we adjust. And I think one thing that I love about you is your honesty and willingness to share these lessons, because I think a lot of filmmakers have that kind of scarcity mindset that they're not willing to share information, but it's just so helpful. And I want to get into some of the work you did with Sundance Creative Distribution as well, which was a game changer for all of us struggling in the middle of nowhere of like, how do we, you know, handle all this? So what were some of the lessons you learned off of that first film that you were able to apply to the next one, that maybe stuff you weren't expecting, or, you know, writers and filmmakers who are like, I'm ready for my first film. What do I need to know?
Yeah. And feel free to press me if you feel like these aren't helpful enough, because I'm trying to think of what are the takeaways. But I always have said and truly believe the cast is everything. Mm-hmm. And the reason we got distribution for my first feature was cast. The reason we get into festivals for my films is cast. A better film with lesser known people, we would probably push them out of the running at a festival, because that festival needs to sell tickets. Yep. So I say this a lot, it's not a meritocracy. It's not about making the best film in terms of getting the attention of festival programmers, distributors. And I see this firsthand where, you know, I'm doing this podcast and I get pitched by publicists, guests, and like, if this is a film with no cast and there's no angle that I'm interested in talking to them about, then we say no on the podcast.
Yeah.
And I think that's also part of it, is like, figure out what your angle is for your film, what you're trying to say. That we always say that a lot, like, what are you trying to say? I got really annoyed with that phrase, right? Like, what's your voice? Use your voice. Like, these are really vague things that filmmakers talk about all the time. But what I'm trying to say is, for Bread and Butter, people be like, what's it about? And I'd be like, well, I watched a lot of romantic comedies when I was a kid, and I grew up with a really delusional way of looking at romance. That's the hook that brought people in. It wasn't, this is a rom-com love triangle about a woman who learns how to drive and lose her virginity. You know, like, no one cares about that. I think they care about the intention of the film a little bit more. Yeah. So I'd say, figure out what your hook is, not necessarily what the story of the film is, but like how you're pitching it in a way that people can find it relatable. Try your damnedest to get name cast. And I really don't believe in that pay to play, you know, what do we call that? Like the low hanging fruit actors who will do anything for money, like really find actors who want to act that you don't have to like bribe to be in your projects. And then I like the idea of filmmakers using their work as an education. So talk freely about how much it costs, talk freely about how you made it. I think I built whatever I'm calling my career based off of the fact that I was incredibly transparent about how I made my first feature. And that is a viable thing too, is to build a career talking about your work and writing about it. And then people will be curious and will want to see it too.
Gosh, all that is so great. I'm kind of writing stuff down because I want to keep asking you about it. Well, first, I love this idea that you talked about, which is essentially nobody really cares about the plot. They care about the why you made it. And the why is more important than the what. And it's something I tell writers a lot, because I don't know, there's all this emphasis on like log lines and stuff, and like how to write a great log line. And the thing that I tell to writers when they're pitching is, what's really going to sell somebody is hearing your level of passion and how personal it is to you, right? Yes. So that's the stuff that really connects with people, in the same way that movies connect with us, because we connect to the character on screen. There's a personal kind of connection. And it's the same way with people you're selling films to, people that are funding films, and people that are, you know, PR or marketing or buyers. The same thing kind of applies, which I think is so great to something filmmakers don't do. Like, I created this amazing film, you should notice it. And what they don't do is put themselves in the shoes of the other person who they need a reason to love your film. They need a reason to spotlight your film or to buy your film or to give you money or whatever. So I love all that. So the obvious question is, you're like, casting is everything for us in the middle of nowhere who don't know any names or have any, you know, an uncle that's connected to somebody. How do you find those casts?
And I do think I'm slightly connected, so I'm not going to pretend like that didn't help, right? Mm-hmm. But I have to say, I didn't have a casting director on my first feature, and I did write letters to agents. Cool. I had an entertainment lawyer on board, so I came with the offer letter. I wasn't just kind of unprofessionally sussing out their interest, but I was saying, I'm committed to offer X, Y, and Z.
Did you already have budget in place by the time you made those
offers? I did. And from my perspective as a first-time feature director, you have to.
Yeah.
Unless you have a short that you can say went to Fantasia or Fantastic or Sundance or whatever it is, you need some kind of humble brag or badge of honor to come with. But I can say that, you know, if you have the but they didn't say what's your budget. And when, or if they did, I just said SAG ultra low, you know, they didn't ask for the exact number. So I think that there were some questions I was anticipating that I didn't get, but yeah, that does help. You know, the fact that I went to USC film school helps. The fact that I, you know, my brother, I'm not close with him, but I have a somewhat famous last name because of my brother. And so people might read into that and say, well, that brother might be helping out. Like, who knows? So I would say, it's funny. It's what my brother said to me when I was making my first film. He actually encouraged the opposite. He was like, just make the absolute best movie you can, because you may not have the resources to get to name talent. And I do agree with that. But then I would say, make it genre if you can. Yeah. You know, I really want everyone to work with name talent in this marketplace, because it is the shorthand way to get people's attention. But if it's not possible, you need to find some sort of ally for you. And I think that is the genre space.
Tell me about, how did you first get involved with Sundance and the creative distribution initiative and all that, and kind of set that up, why it existed, what the results of it were? Is there any lasting influence as a result of all that?
Yeah, it's funny. I'll share something in a second. But yeah, so I was working for a distribution consultant, and the job posting came on a WIMPS email digest, Emily Best's former email, you know, salon that she ran. And I was like, I am perfect for this. And it was a description of, it was then called Artist Services. And the idea was, it was the person at Sundance who oversaw the relationship with Kickstarter, did distribution consulting, and supported the alumni. And I like had just spent 3 years working with a distribution consultant, had done 2 Kickstarter campaigns. Like, it just was like, oh, and I've always wanted to work at Sundance. Like most people, I think, probably want to work at Sundance. I applied, I worked like hell to get that job. I got it. And I learned that Sundance is just as chaotic and confusing as the rest of the world. I thought, oh, well, this is Sundance. They have it figured out. I want to work there. No, it's a mess there too. And everyone's kind and lovely and works their heart out, but it's a very large organization and there's a lot of things going on at the same time. And there's problems with communication and overlap and things like that. When I was there, my department, a year after working there, my boss just comes to me one day and he's like, we're going to evolve this department. Here's a new name. And we were called Creative, I think there was Creative Funding and Distribution or something. And then we changed it again to the Creative Distribution Initiative. And then I learned, all right, we're going to do this fellowship. I need you to help me build it with me. And so we built this fellowship that we, you know, I want to give Chris Horton all the credit. He built the fellowship. It's his idea. But I built the application. I corresponded with various members of different departments at Sundance. And we essentially created this fellowship where we funded filmmakers to self-distribute their work and then acquiesce to have us document everything that they did and publish these case studies, and they're available.
What was the problem that you guys saw that you were trying to solve with that initiative?
Well, what my boss saw was that he thought that there was what he called I call mid-tier filmmakers a very different filmmaker, but he called mid-tier filmmakers as like Sundance Festival films that would get that, whose budgets were like maybe 750, 800, somewhere around there, low budget for Sundance, were getting deals where the MG was like 1/5 of the budget of the film. And so he was trying to solve, if I may say, I could be totally wrong, but like he was trying to solve this idea of like the marketplace isn't meeting the means of production in a way. And like maybe self-distribution is the way to maximize all of your windows and all of your rights and be a great alternative to like the 150K MG from a mid-tier distributor. That's what he saw. And those are the films that he targeted. I co-opted the program when I pitched it around to say, this is an opportunity for us. This is an opportunity for the micro-budget filmmaker to learn about the importance of reducing middlemen and women and what can we learn from these mid-tier films who have, I think, sometimes inflated budgets. How can we take what they learned and apply it to our smaller projects and make even more money?
That's awesome.
I didn't get my way, by the way. I don't know if you've seen the end of this story, but the closest thing I got was our fourth film that we supported was Thunder Road. And that was, I think, a 300K budget, somewhere around there. I could be speaking out of turn again. And they were an outlier in every way. I mean, Jim is a hero of indie film. Vanishing Angle is like stellar. Yeah. It's not a replicable case study.
Right.
What I wanted was to do a film that I thought could be replicable, but we learned so much from working with the Thunder Road team, and they amplified our program, and then our program dissolved. So it was, they were wonderful teammates. I'm just saying, like, every film that got supported were genius, fantastic filmmakers who all already had that leg up in that elevator to success. Yep. And I was really hoping, how can I support filmmakers who are not on that elevator yet?
Yeah, the two big ones that you guys did that I looked at was Columbus, which that filmmaker already had a giant following. You had decent name in the cast.
John Cho. Yeah, I mean, like Haley Lou Richardson, amazing film. Sundance. Again, these are Sundance films.
Right. And Thunder Road, Jim Cummings is a personality of himself, a giant following. And so, yeah, they had that extra something that is really difficult for us in the middle of nowhere to replicate. So I'm curious though, was there anything that you personally took out of that experience for your own films that you were doing?
I think that we looked at every film and kind of set them up in the same way each time, which is like, we asked them their goals, you know, and a lot of films wanted a theatrical. That was really important to them. And this was back in like 2017, 2018. Yeah. pre-pandemic. And, you know, we would say, okay, well, as an independent filmmaker, you could work with something called a film booker. And what they do is they pitch the film and they figure out deliverables. Like, I learned actually the intricacies of every single teammate in the release of a film. Like, essentially, we formed mini distribution companies around each film and figured out what teammates they needed and what the budget was. So when I released my second feature, I had the confidence to book my own theatrical. I had the confidence to pitch airline distributors, to pitch, you know, to do promotions in a way that I thought was, I was always afraid of marketing, but I kind of learned a little bit about the importance of key art and trailers. So yeah, I took away a lot. And I think the thing is the self-distribution these days is doing the exact same thing a distributor would, but on your own, knowing your audience and maybe not charging for, you know, not putting in the budget your trip to Cannes to pitch the film in a market. But what I'm more interested in now is like, what are we missing? Like, what can be done that's not part of the standard way of releasing content?
Yeah. I think what I love about this conversation is, because I feel like we're being a little kind of inside baseball with this stuff, but I think it's good because I think because this is a mostly writer podcast, but because indie film friends and stuff, I always have them on to talk about the process and all that. that even for writers that want to make movies, they don't realize the business side of it. And so much of movie making is about the business. And you really have to learn all these ins and outs in order to be really successful at it, or partner with the right people who care about that stuff, whether that be a producer or a collaborator of some sort that does care about that kind of stuff. So I wanted to transition a little bit, because I think this goes into what you guys are doing with this Constellation Incubator a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. So this will come out, I think, just like 3 days before your deadline. And so I want to try to push as many people to it as possible. But tell us a little bit how this came together and kind of your goal with this incubator.
Yeah. So Naomi McDougall Jones, it's her idea. And I want to give her 1,000 points of credit. She came to me one day and she's like, can we talk? And we kind of knew each other. We didn't really, yeah, were acquaintances. And I was like, okay. And we set up a Zoom and she was like, indie film is broken. And I was like, that's really interesting you say that. And she's like, yeah, and we discussed how we think it's broken, how we don't think it's serving the artist. And she's like, I think there's a system that I want to explore that I would like you to explore with me. And I was like, okay. And I had really low self-esteem about it the whole time. I'm like, are you sure you want to work together? Like, I don't know. This sounds really cool. You could change your mind. And she's like, no, I came to you. I want to do this with you. And we had all these chats with, I don't know, maybe a dozen or two dozen people in the indie film space that we thought had done innovative things in terms of distribution. Yeah. And we just kind of picked their brain for a few weeks. And then we thought, okay, I think the model that we want to do is create an incubator. And an incubator, in the way that we define it, is essentially we're going to get together. Our goal is 36 filmmaking teams on a regular basis over like an 8-week period. We're going to meet regularly, but not in a way that would like kill anyone's schedule. We're thinking like, yeah, 2 hours a week at most, maybe on a weekend evening, something like that. And we're going to look at film from a bird's eye view. If this were another industry, would they just laugh at our procedures? Like, what does tech do that we don't do? What does the retail do? What does the service industry do? And so we're bringing experts from other industries, and we're actually going to take a course, me, Naomi, and our two amazing co-founders, Abini Bloodworth and Angela Harmon. We're going to take a course on design thinking, which I don't even understand. That's why I'm taking the course. But it's like, how do you approach a problem and find a solution and like rejigger your mind to figure out completely alternative, new alternatives that you're not even thinking about? How do you look outside of the paradigm? Yeah. So the incubator it's listed as a script competition on Film Freeway, but it's not. We're asking for people, whether they're writers, directors, producers, people from all parts of the industry to come in. You have to have a project that you want to apply things to, but we're not looking to read your project. We're not curators of content. We're curators of people right now. And the idea is that we're going to all get in a room for the next 8 weeks and try to redesign the entire industry from the ground up and then apply those tenets to our projects.
Man, I love that so much. That gets me so excited, because I've asked that question so many times of like, why are we doing it this way? You know, because so many filmmakers come to me, hey, I've got this movie. We're trying to raise like $1 million for it. And like some of my favorite films were cost 20 grand and it had a crew of 5 people and they just did a road trip, you know? And like, and I hate that I don't see more people trying to do that kind of thing, because you're well aware that there's a dollar figure, especially without a cast, that you can only make your money back if you keep it under a certain figure, or you can ramp up maybe with certain key pieces like you're talking about. You fit in a strong genre, or you have a great cast member who pulls in an audience. But it's like, we're looking at, it goes back to the business thing. We're looking at indie film as art when so much of it is business, or it at least is an equal balance of the two. And so we say, oh, it costs $1 million because movies cost $1 million. It's like, well, is it worth $1 million?
Right.
Yeah.
And like Netflix has completely devalued what people will pay for a film. But I want to go back to what you said, because I have the same gut, right? Like, can we just be a family, a small family for a few days and go and make this movie? But I think what we also want to test is when are we exploiting labor and when are we crossing the boundaries of asking right. too much? That's so great. We're also looking at the other end, which is like, what if a pod was formed of filmmaking teams and we all use the same lawyer? You split the fees across five films. Maybe we reduce costs in a way, I think Naomi calls it like the wholesale method rather than just like exploiting the labor of five teammates, which I, again, it's a labor of love. And I've done the same exact thing in all my films. We've worked these 12 to 14 hour days. It's exhausting. Mm-hmm. But what if you reduce it on the other end? So we're thinking about that too. What if you have one location for all films and you pre-light it and then you just play for the whole day? You know what I mean? What can you do to make it easier, but still fun and still maintain your sanity too?
Yeah, there's, you know, we're in Atlanta. So like Tyler Perry does some really creative stuff like this. We're in his studios where he'll have one set and they'll shoot like 80 pages a day because it's all these shows where different casts will come in and shoot on the same set. And it's already pre-lit and pre-set up, like you're saying, and just get a ton of stuff done. Yeah. I mean, I just love people that are just thinking outside of the box like that. So I'm planning on applying for this because I'm very excited. Hey. I want to go through it. And I hope you guys are getting a lot of attention for it. This is coming out a little too late to really put a spotlight on it. But I have been telling all my indie film friends, sign up for this thing, sign up for this thing, sign up for this thing. So I think it's going to be awesome.
We have 13 applications right now. I get really competitive about things like this. So I really want thousands, which is not healthy. Our goal is 150. I don't think we're going to hit it. And I think it's because we ran into this with our fellowship at Sundance. You have to introduce a problem, define the problem, and then identify the opportunity all in like one page. Yeah. So it's hard for people to understand what we're doing. And the word incubator, I think, may throw people off. But I'm hoping that maybe if people listen to this podcast, which I'm sure they will, not if they listen, but when they listen, they'll see that there's like a whole vision for this. And we kept the application fee really low. I call it, I think it's 2.5 Chipotle meals. And that's like the way I view it. So that we, again, didn't want to undervalue people evaluating the applications, but we didn't want to take advantage of those applying.
That's awesome. I'm going to do my best to get the word out about that. Cause I just I think it's a game changer. Honestly, I just think it'll change the way people think about it. And I know the influence that you have and Naomi has. So I'm very excited about it.
I appreciate it.
I wanted to ask, because you kind of touched on it a little bit, of a personal brand, you know, of putting yourself out there. You know, you do your podcast and that helps you make the films. But that can be really stressful. It's hard enough for us to make movies. It's hard enough for us to try to do the business side of that. And we also have to have a public platform and face and network and all these kind of things. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about that and how you manage that without getting burned out, and what advice you would give for either writers or filmmakers who are like, how do I get myself out there?
I get this a lot because I do a lot of mentorship or consulting or speaking. And that's like the number one question is like people's fears of self-promotion is one of that. People not wanting to talk about themselves, people already exhausted, people not liking social media. Like there's just a long list of reasons why people have a hard time getting on the train of the personal brand. I could tell you that I think listening to all those very, very legitimate thoughts, I'm just like, I must be a narcissist because like, I love it. I love doing podcasts. I love writing about my projects. I love putting my face out there and doing speaking engagements. So I think I might just be, you know, super vain, and that's what's going on for me. And that's why I'm okay with it.
I take away from that is like, look, suck it up and just do it. Like to some degree, you do have to. Yeah,
you do. And I think you get used to it. But I think when I realize that the more I'm myself, that actually the better my films do, I was like, oh, I'm just committing to this 100%. There are ways to kind of fold in your personal brand in a way that you may be more comfortable with. It could be, you know, I was talking to a bunch of Australian filmmakers about this, and they were like, what if I did a blog? And in the blog, I just answered questions. I'm like, that's great. If you feel better writing, that's wonderful. You're going to have to market that blog to get people to read it. Mm-hmm. But I think that's fine. And I do a newsletter. I'm a big advocate for newsletters. And with newsletters, you can also hide behind a template there too. You can say paragraph intro, how you doing? This is what I've done this past month. Here are podcast appearances. here's the link to pre-order my film, done, right?
That's great.
Self-promotion, I think, can be annoying. I'm not going to avoid acknowledging that. But I think if you are humble, if you have a sense of humor about it, if you're vulnerable rather than like a robot or like overly confident, I think that's really gross when people are like, look at me, I'm a success. I think it should always be coming through this lens of like, surprise. I am surprised that I did this well and I want to celebrate it. And that's genuinely how I feel when I announce things. I'm always like, that is shocking. I'm going to post it on Twitter. But I think it's all about the way you do it. And I think you could do it in a very vulnerable, authentic way if you just speak from the heart.
Fantastic. I wanted to ask, in real practical terms, I've got a screenplay. I have no money or connections. I want to make this movie. What would the first step be in order to make it happen?
I always say, get a line producer or a first AD on board. That is like your first thing. I mean, okay, well, so maybe your first thing is to get a producer on board, but maybe people don't know producers. So I would say, try to find someone who can break down your script and tell you approximately how many days you would shoot it in and approximately what would be the budget you need. And when you look at those numbers, you're going to start to really test yourself and say, do I really need that cute little dog in scene 5? And do I really need that earthquake? And you're going to start asking yourself questions. And maybe there are some things that cannot be killed. You know, maybe you really need that earthquake. So you figure out what's the lowest possible number that you can make this movie for with the like a 10% contingency, like always have that cushion. And you don't need to work with that AD on your film. You're just hiring them for what they break down. And then I would say the next thing to do is find a partner, whether it's a producer, a cinematographer, an editor, find someone who's accountable with you to make this project and set dates. Even if they sound imaginary, they are imaginary. So that's why they sound that way. Yeah. And maybe it's like a year from now, maybe it's June 1st, 2022. And you say, we're going to fucking make this movie on June 1st, 2022. And then you work backwards, you know, how can you figure out a timeline to get you to that point? So, you know, budget money comes, doesn't mean you're going to get all the money you want, but you're going to find a way, or you're going to make the movie for $0. So don't wait till you have the budget. Don't wait till you have the cast. You actually have to get the movie in shape and the team built and the train running on the track before you can really put all those other pieces together.
I love how practical you make it. And all of that is the exact same experience we had making our film and making the next one we're doing. And the date thing is so important too, because you're moving towards a goal and the momentum is either going to keep building or it's going to fizzle out, and you know that this isn't the right moment or the right one to do. But unless you have that you're moving forward to, that momentum's, the ball's never going to start rolling or the train's never going to leave the station, right? Yeah.
And there's something about, like, let's say you go to a networking event or a Zoom or whatever, and someone's like, what are you doing? And then you go, oh, I'm making this movie June 1st, 2022. Other people take you seriously. Yeah, and that's awesome. I know it's like very thin, right? But it's like, that actually is a big deal.
Yeah. And you're putting it out there, and and that's how stuff gets made. One of my favorite quotes is Brian Koppelman, who says that the line between delusion and success is paper thin, and you're delusional up until the point you're successful, which is so true. But, and so like, yeah, there, it might sound crazy to be like, hey, we're making a movie next year, but it's not going to happen without that kind of ridiculous attitude towards it.
Yeah. And I think a degree of faith is important. I've just heard this from a few filmmakers where they're always worried about what their first film is going to be about. And they're like, well, I don't know if this is the first film. I don't know if it brands me. And I think at some point we were told that first film has to be you coming out the gate strong. And I think you have to think of your career as a long game, and that you will, like, first of all, there's so much content that first film could easily get forgotten. So don't presume that it's going to brand you forever. But second of all, like, you're going to win people over as you build the career. So it's okay if your first film is not exactly everything you wanted. You actually just have to get it done. Yep. I feel you just have to get it over with.
So great. I love it. All right. So we're going to finish up with five kind of rapid fire questions. So, first one is, what do you write?
I seem to write relationship dramedies that pull in dialogue and scenarios from my own life. I seem to write that. So what I want to write is, and what I find the most joy writing is a good joke.
Which is such a great art form in its own, a good joke. What's your proudest accomplishment?
My son. I can't not say it. The fact that I pushed an entity out of me and have managed to keep him alive up until now is something I'm endlessly proud of. But for those who do not want children or do not have children, I don't want to, that's always like a thing where I don't want to be like, well, I have a child. Right. But for me, he brings me endless joy and I'm just very proud of him.
Love it. How do you define success?
Well, I define it as completely unattainable for myself. I think success is feeling like you're at the party, even if you're not winning the Oscars, but feeling like you could be in consideration on someday. So to me, success is being invited.
Is there a part of you that always hopes it's a little out of reach because it, you know, you never want to arrive and relax?
Yeah, I listened to this great podcast. It's called, oh my God, Heavyweight by Jonathan Goldstein. And he interviewed Moby, and Moby talks about at the height of his success being like really depressed. And so, yeah, I don't think I'll ever like achieve that kind of success / depression. And it sounds like I don't want to.
Right. What writers do you most look up to and why?
I mean, I don't read anymore because of aforementioned pride child, but yeah. My favorite writer is in terms of screenplays is Nora Ephron, and just in general, Nora Ephron, because I think she's honest and clever and very easy and unpretentious. And my favorite writer in prose or like fiction is John Irving, because he is pretentious and really dense and really interesting to me. So for the most part, I tend to skew towards overly clever writers.
Nora Ephron's one that when I rewatch her movies, I notice new things every time. And like it's so well just paced and just every little bit of cleverness hidden away and tucked in these corners and stuff. She's amazing. What advice would you give to your younger self?
That's funny. We asked this question on our podcast and I think I answered it, but it, I answered it then saying contracts, which was a very cold answer. But what I advise, I mean, I'm very hard on myself. I'm just like ridiculously hard on myself. Like most of us, right? We're all just like way too hard on ourselves. And I think I would just want to be like, hey, I'm doing okay. Like you could relax for a few years and you'll get to where I am. And I'm okay. I'm not where I want to be, but it's not bad over here. So I would try to make myself a little less anxious.
All right. How can someone find out more about you if they want to maybe hire you as a consultant on something that they're doing or want to sign up for this Constellation Incubator? Where can they find you and more information about all that?
Well, for the incubator, you just search on Film Freeway for Constellation Incubator. And I think it's just filmfreeway.com/Constellation Incubator. My name, LizManischel@gmail.com. You can just email me. Or if you want to look at my website that stuck 5 years ago, is LizManischel.com.
And I would recommend filmmakers looking at your film websites as well, because I think you do a great job of making very clear and clean websites. So
thank you. It's just Squarespace.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. This was absolutely the like life and career affirming for me chatting with you today. This was so great.
I really do hope you apply to the incubator. It'd be great to have you.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you guys so much for listening. And thanks again to Liz for her openness about her filmmaking experience. It's important for directors to open up about all aspects of filmmaking, especially the hardest steps. And Liz is constantly being mindful of being a good example of this. And along with her co-founders at the Constellation Incubator, she's paving the way to changing how we view the indie filmmaking process and setting new standards of how we can tell our own stories. If you have a project and a team and want to get your movie's development off the road, be sure to submit your work to the Constellation Incubator at filmfreeway.com/Constellation Incubator. The deadline is this Thursday, April 15th, so don't forget to sign up. But if you're on the other end of the spectrum and find yourself struggling to get your creative wheels spinning, or you're having a hard time understanding the ins and outs of screenwriting, be sure to check out Script Blast members to get feedback, polish your writing, and be a part of an awesome community while building productive habits and a positive mindset. Get a free week when you join at members.scriptblast.com. And if you have any more questions about the group, the podcast, or questions about writing in general, shoot Hudson an email at hudson@scriptblast.com. See ya.